The fighting in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, says Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, is not his fault.
The Georgian leadership has taken very aggressive steps against South Ossetia and virtually started hostilities using heavy weaponry, artillery, tanks, and there are victims, people killed and wounded.
That's Putin through a translator. It's day four in the conflict between Georgia and Russia. No one knows how many casualties there are. European mediators are on the way. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, a Russian expert, burned the midnight oil. The UN Security Council is holding emergency meetings. Is this the Cold War take two? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 11th. I'm Catherine Lamb for in for John Hockenberry, who's away. In addition to the latest from the conflict in Georgia, we're also going to splash around the Olympics this morning, both in and out of the pool. Tune into Black Radio, chat with a literary outlaw, and remember the iconic Isaac Hayes. That's all coming up this hour, but first, these headlines. Hey, good morning, Adora.
Good morning, Catherine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is slamming the U.S. for airlifting Georgian troops back home from Iraq. The U.S. military is flying 2,000 recalled Georgian soldiers back home. President Bush says he has urged both Russia and Georgia to end the fighting over the breakaway province of South Ossetia.
I only said it to Vladimir Putin. I said it to the president of the country, Dmitry Medvedev. And my administration has been engaged with both sides in this, trying to get a ceasefire.
Russian planes are continuing to pound targets inside Georgia. Bolivia's populist president, Evo Morales, has won a referendum vote that should keep him in power. But the vote did nothing to unify Bolivia. The country has split along class lines as Morales attempts to redistribute petroleum royalties and privatize farmland among Bolivia's indigenous majority.
Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf is waiting to hear the charges against him that may lead to his impeachment. Governing coalition leaders will meet today to finalize their plan to remove him from office. Musharraf says he will not step down. It may be days before Musharraf hears the charges against him. Tributes continue today for legendary soul singer and songwriter Isaac Hayes. Hayes was pronounced dead yesterday after his family found him unconscious near a treadmill in his Memphis home. The exact cause of death has not been determined. Isaac Hayes was 65 years old.
U.S. Olympic swimmer Jason Lezak turned in a stunning come-from-behind win in the men's 400 freestyle relay to help teammate Michael Phelps win his second gold medal. This keeps Phelps on track for his goal of winning 8 gold medals in Beijing. The National Lundberg Survey says the price of a gallon of gas has dropped to $3.85. That's a drop of almost 15 cents in the past 2 weeks. Oil prices are also dropping. They're just over $115 in Asian trading. The Dow was up more than 2.5% to close at 11,734, and the S&P was up over 2%. It opens at 1296. Today, we're going to be talking with Lee Israel. She successfully forged letters from Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward. Who would you forge from? Let us know at The Takeaway. That's my takeaway, takeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, a senior general says Russian troops plan to stay put in two breakaway Georgian provinces and not move further into Georgian territory. That's a former Soviet republic. The general says Russia has demanded that Georgian troops near Abkhazia disarm. Georgia fears Russia may open a second front in the conflict over South Ossetia. We're joined in the line from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, by BBC correspondent Matthew Collin. Matthew, thanks for being with us.
Hello from Georgia.
Can you describe to us what you've seen today? Is there fighting still happening? Are people fleeing?
Well, earlier today, a Russian military jet allegedly bombed a radar station just near the center of the capital, Tbilisi, on a hill above the capital. The Russians have denied this. There's also been reports of other Russian airstrikes around the country. The Russians again have denied this and have also denied targeting any civilians. The major development here has been an attempt to broker a ceasefire led by the European Union. The European Union sent in the French foreign minister with a document which he wanted President Saakashvili, the Georgian president, to sign, and then he planned to go on to Moscow to get the Russian president to sign it as well. Well, Mr. Saakashvili has signed, but the Russians say they will not. The Russians have accused Georgian forces of still carrying out military operations and say while that continues, they can't even consider signing this pledge on a ceasefire. So what seemed very hopeful for a few minutes is now not very hopeful at all.
There's been a lot of accusations back and forth, and I should say, among the breakaway republics, as well as Georgia, as well as Russia. Let's just start with the casualty numbers. Do you have any sense of exactly how many people have been wounded and how many people have fled? You see anywhere between 50 and 1,000 wounded or dead, and tens of thousands fleeing, having left South Ossetia or Abkhazia?
Well, we haven't really got very much clarity on how many people have been killed in this fighting since Thursday here in Georgia, but the Georgian president said he thought it was in the hundreds. We've also heard statements from the other side, the Russian side, talking in similar numbers, maybe a bit larger. So we're talking about a very, very high level of casualties in what is a very small country. In terms of the people who've been fleeing their homes, a lot of them have been fleeing the fighting in this small breakaway enclave of South Ossetia that the battle was initially all about. We believe, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, 40,000 people have fled from a Georgian town near to the conflict zone, anticipating a Russian assault on the town. Of course, there was no indication that that would definitely happen, and the Russians never said they would attack, but people felt under threat there. So 40,000 people fled from there, another 15,000 from Georgian villages within the conflict zone. And it's also believed from the Russian side, already 14,000 people have fled across the border into Russia. So we're talking about a very large-scale conflict for what is a very small country.
And Matthew, you're talking about tensions that simmered for quite some time along the border there of Russia. How would you describe what's expected to happen next? If the Georgians have signed this ceasefire, the Russians are refusing to do so, what now?
Well, I think we can look to the words of Russia's Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin. He said that Russia wanted to take its operation to its logical conclusion. Now, as far as the Georgians are concerned, what that means is that Russia wants again to bring its former Soviet colony to its knees. That's how Georgians see it. What they see is Russian tanks on Georgian soil. They see Russian planes in the Georgian skies, and they feel that the Kremlin is again trying to dominate and subjugate its much, much smaller neighbor. And also, they believe
much,
that the Kremlin
much smaller,
is trying,
right, Matthew? Because we're talking about a Russian army of our military of over a million people, and you've got about 20,000 troops in Georgia.
That's right. That's right. And of course, questions have been asked. Was Georgia somewhat foolhardy in starting to try and take back this little breakaway region of South Ossetia, which we must remember is only like 1.5 times the size of Luxembourg with a population of 70,000. So we're not talking about a very large area that was being fought over. Was Georgia being foolhardy by going against these separatists who've got their strong links to Moscow
and
provoking the fury of Moscow?
And that's something that they're going to have to think about for some time. Matthew Collin, I'm going to have to leave it right there. Thank you. Matthew Collin, correspondent for our partner, the BBC World Service, reporting from the Georgia capital of Tbilisi.
And now, Adore, we are going to go from that conflict to a happier locale. We're going to go to Beijing, where we're going to join in with Jeremy Schapp. He is covering his 7th Olympics for ESPN. Now, Jeremy, before we even get to the sports, it seems like everyone always wants to know what the weather is like in Beijing. How's it doing there?
Well, it's a lot better than it was a few days ago, I'll tell you that. I mean, the skies are much clearer. It's not nearly as hot and humid. Well, it might be technically as humid because it has been raining for the better part of the last couple of days, but the conditions much more manageable than they had been. It was really miserable here for a few days, but this kind of adheres to the standard pattern. You get a really bad, terrible week, which was last week, and then things start to improve a little bit. It was only about, 80 degrees today and a little bit rainy, but much more comfortable.
And we should remind everyone, you are calling from Beijing, where we're coming up on sunset. What a day today. Let's start, of course, with the men's relay team and Jason Lezak.
Yeah, I mean, really a remarkable performance. Of course, everything has been reduced to mission Spitz for Michael Phelps to win 8 gold medals to eclipse Mark Spitz's record of 7 gold medals in a single game from 1972. But he can't do it alone. He needs his teammates in the relays, obviously, to come through. And Jason Lezak, who is 32 years old, not quite as old as his female counterpart, Dara Torres, but old enough for a swimmer, put on a spectacular show in the anchor leg of the 4x100. 100-meter freestyle relay to secure for Phelps his 2nd gold medal of the Games and to keep him perfect. Lezak needed to outrace one of the fastest swimmers in the world, Alain Bernard of France, to win the gold medal. He just out-touched him at the wall. The U.S. set a world record. In fact, the 5 teams that finished 1 through 5 all were better than the previous world record. And so Jason Lezak keeping Michael Phelps' dream of 8 gold medals alive today. A spectacular race, really. If you haven't had a chance to see it yet, you should watch it.
And let's talk for a minute about some of the other people on this freestyle relay team.
There were 4 racing today in the final, and also of significance, Cullen Jones from the New York tri-state area became only the 2nd American of African descent to win a swimming gold medal at the Games. And he didn't have his best race. His was the slowest of the 4 legs, but still awfully fast and good enough to help the U.S. win this event, which did not win in the last 2 Olympics, which is unusual if you look back at the scope of Olympic relay swimming history, which the U.S. tends to dominate.
Now, another team and game that was in the news, U.S. men's volleyball team, they just played a game without their coach, whose father-in-law, a prominent citizen of Minneapolis, Minnesota, Mr. Bachman, was murdered in China. Talk about the game for that team.
Yeah, yesterday the U.S. men's volleyball team played Venezuela, and obviously all minds were on Barbara Bachman, who was still in the hospital. She is still in the hospital. Her condition has been upgraded from critical to serious. She was with her husband when he was attacked and murdered. She was seriously wounded, as I just said. They were with their daughter, Elizabeth, who was a member of the U.S. women's volleyball team 4 years ago in Athens, and their son-in-law, Hugh McCutcheon, the head coach of the U.S. men's volleyball team. He was not with the team. He was at his mother-in-law's bedside when the U.S. Defeated Venezuela yesterday. And tomorrow, the U.S. plays again. They play Italy. And obviously, no one knows at this point
just
whether
a heart. Yeah, Jeremy.
Return.
Jeremy, this is Adore. It's a heartbreaking story. But let me ask you a quick question. I know you. You haven't been at 7 Olympics.
Yes, 7.
When did you start? When you were 2 years old?
No, I was 22 in Albertville. I was, I was already voting and drinking and all those things,
All right.
Legally.
Well, some of us haven't been to one yet, and we're hoping to do it. Jeremy Schapp, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jeremy
guys.
Schapp, apparently covering his 7th Olympics for ESPN. We're going to have more on the Olympics and other news here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. Now, we've been asking you this morning, which literary luminary would you like to forge? Whose letters would you make up? Well, hopefully, of course, this would be for good and not for evil, like this listener.
Well, I'm afraid I'll have to remain anonymous, you know, admitting this. I've been forging letters from God. I've fallen on hard times, so I send myself letters, and I open them, and they say, I'm really proud of you, kid. You're doing a heck of a job. Hang in there. It's going to get better. And I read it. Of course, not very critically. I just go, wow, swell. And I have a great morning.
All right. Whose letters would you forge, whether celestial or merely terrestrial? Call in to 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And Catherine, today we're tracking a cultural trend in radio, one that advertisers and political operators are watching really closely. Millions and millions and millions of African American listeners have traditionally been the most loyal in radio. But this election cycle, Takeaway contributor Patrick Henry Bass, he's arguing that black radio programs are taking a big step from traditional radio entertainment and comedy and fun, and are taking a critical look at issues in the community, issues that the community cares about, like, say, Senator Barack Obama. Patrick Henry Bass is the senior editor of Essence. He joins us now. Good morning, Patrick, and give us your best shot at the argument here.
The best shot at the argument? The first time I heard Barack Obama was on the Wendy Williams Show. The first time I heard him on radio, and that was not an accident. At a time, seasons ago, when we were questioning Barack Obama's blackness, mainstream media went to places like, to people like Deborah Dickerson and thinkers like Skip Gates, and what the Obama campaign did, which was brilliant, they went right to the heart of the black community by going on black radio stations like the Tom Joyner in the Morning Show and Michael Bazin. These folks are in tune with African-American listeners and the African-American voter, unlike any other. And what's been most proven was the South Carolina campaign when Hillary Clinton lost. And a lot of people credited Oprah Winfrey with that. It was not Oprah Winfrey. It was Tom Joyner. It was Michael Bazin. It was Bev Smith, who really wanted the African-American voter to show their support for the Obama campaign.
And those are all radio shows, the ones that you've just talked about.
Exactly.
National radio shows that reach somewhere between 15 and 20 million people together.
Absolutely.
A week.
Right. Well, what we have now in African-American media is a disappearance of content. So we only have very few magazines. We have very few African-American newspapers. But African-American radio stations are surging.
And that's nearly half the population that we're talking about, that a variety of these shows that they actually reach. So talk about this notion that somehow it's not all about entertainment in the morning or in drive time, or not all about music or comedy, that there is a real effort afoot,
right,
to
exactly
address very specific issues.
Right. Well, what we've seen in African-American radio over the last two generations is a great transition. There's been historical context to African-American commentators like Georgie Woods from WDAS, and there was Frankie Crocker on WBLS, and Petey Green, who was in the movie
in DC,
Talk to Me,
right? Yeah.
And so what they used to do, they used to play music and provide commentary throughout. That commentary became shtick and comedy with the Tom Joyner in the Morning Show until he introduced Tavis Smiley as a commentator in 1996. And so what listeners want more is commentary and information as opposed to the shtick and the bits. And Tom Joyner has responded to that in a great way, galvanizing listeners to go out and vote. He's been raising issues about voter intimidation, having online polling.
He testified in Congress, as
Absolutely.
A matter of fact, on Capitol Hill, about the tens of thousands of phone calls that he got about voter intimidation
right.
across the country.
Exactly. And it's not just Tom Joyner. It's people like Amos Brown, who's in Indianapolis. Let's take a listen to him.
All right, so here's the other thing. Should Obama continue campaigning like Sidney Poitier, or does he need to get like Denzel?
You know, I think a bit of both.
Oh, he needs a bit, all right,
a bit of both.
So I need
think,
to add a both
however,
category.
I think he needs to be, of course, stay the way he always is.
Mm-hmm.
But he should get some mad dogs and to do some sniping.
Well, maybe that's part of the reason you get a vice presidential candidate. You need somebody that's going to be the junkyard dog.
That's as real as it gets. I mean, that's what you'll hear at a barbershop or a beauty parlor, and that's why African-American listeners cling to African-American radio, because it's the best possible representation of who we are.
But just to be clear, it's not just people who are advocating on the behalf of Barack Obama, because there's certainly been spirited discussion among us African-Americans about people who support him and then those who are critical of some of the things he does. So it's really been an open debate.
It really has, exactly. But there's been a great great deal of criticism to African-American radio that they are cheerleaders for Obama. They will argue that the same criticism isn't being launched at Rush Limbaugh or Laura Ingraham in conservative radio.
Well, in fact, talking about Rush Limbaugh, how much is this rising black radio sort of an answer to Rush Limbaugh?
Well, it's a great antidote, because what the Democratic Party often did, they only reached out to African-American listeners the last week of the campaign. And you will hear this massive get out the vote surge, and African-American listeners were not familiar or comfortable with John Kerry or Al Gore even the first time that, you know, he ran. But with Barack Obama's candidacy, there was a proactive approach to getting out and supporting this candidate, mainly because the Obama campaign came to them. They came to black talk shows.
And so as we move forward, obviously lots of people who are paying attention, watching, listening to what the topics are that have been brought up
exactly
on these radio shows.
Right, and what you said about criticism is exactly right. And our point, Tavis Smiley was greatly derided for critiquing the Obama campaign, and he ended up alienating a lot of Tom Joyner's listeners.
Our friend Patrick Henry Bass, thank you. Patrick is the senior editor at Essence Magazine and a takeaway contributor. Lots to debate there. Anyhow, we're going to move on to some headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thanks very much, Adora. Coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, Bolivia's populist leader, Evo Morales, has won a referendum vote that will keep him in power. But Bolivia remains heavily divided along class lines. Morales wants to redistribute petroleum revenue and land among people in Bolivia's impoverished indigenous majority. Two gold medals down and six to go for U.S. Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, who says he wants to win 8 gold medals at the Beijing Games. Phelps' teammate Jason Lezak turned in a stunning come-from-behind win in the men's 400 freestyle relay. Investigators are trying to determine what caused the bus to veer off the road south of Las Vegas and slam into a guardrail. 20 people were injured. It's the third serious bus wreck on U.S. highways in as many days. And fighting between Russia and neighboring Georgia rages for a fourth day, with leaders from both nations trading accusations on who's responsible for the violence. In the meantime, it's civilians that are caught in the middle of all of the bombardments. Have a listen to this little snippet of an interview from the BBC earlier this morning. It's from a little place called Tsingvali in South Ossetia.
Destroyed, demolished town, and fire everywhere. The houses are burnt down. Destroyed right to the basement. This is what we see. If we keep on speaking for some 2 or 3 minutes, you'll hear the sound. Just listen.
That's Mira, a teacher who lives in South Ossetia.
More thanks, Femi.
From that region soon.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. John Hockenberry's away. Lee Israel was a respected and best-selling biographer of showbiz characters like Tallulah Bankhead when she found herself in the early 90s with a flopped book, an empty bank account, and on the wrong side of 50. She was getting by in a pastiche of welfare checks and assignments for Soap Opera Digest when she got the idea to write for Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward and other literary luminaries. The fact that they were dead didn't stop her. It enabled her to begin a life of crime in which she forged hundreds of letters and autographs that she then sold to dealers. She details this life of literary crime in her new memoir, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And she joins us here in the studio. Hey, Lee, welcome.
Catherine, hello. The fact that they were dead enabled me to do it. They would have probably objected.
They probably would have. Could you please give us a portrait, if you will, of where you were and what was going on in your life when you started on this path?
Well, I was in my apartment at 98 Riverside Drive, my small apartment that I'd had for years, and I was at the point of not being able to pay the rent and on the verge of eviction, and my cat was ill and I couldn't afford to diagnose her properly, which was the proximate cause of my transgressions. I was poor. I was dirt poor. I wasn't eating roots in Somalia, but I was in trouble.
And what was the first step you took on this journey?
I guess I stole some Fanny Bryce letters from Lincoln Center Library. They were small little bread and butter notes. They didn't seem to mean anything. And I needed $40 to pay my cat's doctor. And I took the letters and I sold them across the park to Argosy Bookstore. And I had some jingle in my jeans for the first time in a very long time.
Let's move from that first step to the full flower, if you will, of your life of crime. You were forging letters for Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward. How did you even do that?
Well, I got what I called an Ur letter, which was the letter on which I based other letters. I took note of the style, the indention, spaces between paragraphs, spaces between sentences. And I, with an old typewriter, which would have been coeval with these particular writers, I made up stuff that they could have and would have said in a letter.
How did you do that?
I researched. I got into the skin of. I knew I've had an ear for such a thing because I'd written biography. I'd written satire. So I combined the two, research, good ear, and an ability to get within the style and the persona of people with iconic large personalities that had always attracted me.
Was anybody ever suspicious of any of these letters? Because you wrote dozens and dozens and sold dozens and dozens of them.
Yeah, of course they were. It was crazy to think that I'd have this huge treasure trove of so many letters. But people were making money. Not all of them became suspicious. Not all of them knew, but certainly some of them, meaning the autograph dealers, came to know.
Did you ever feel bad about those people who thought they were buying an authentic letter when it was just a forgery that you'd created, made up?
I never thought about them. Actually, there was somebody called, one of the dealers called to thank me and to tell me that a school teacher somewhere in Ohio who had bought the letter, a Louise Brooks letter, was thrilled to have it. I've changed the state to protect the innocent here. I hope he's continued, not knowing and continuing to be thrilled with it. But it's a flim-flam business, and I contributed to the flim-flammery.
What sort of remorse do you feel?
I no night sweats. I know that I, about the forgeries, I tell you, frankly, Catherine, none at all. They were fun. They were larky. People made money. People enjoyed them all along, and enjoyed them
now. So why not just make them fiction? It's disturbing a little that this was something that you did that was illegal and that you were deceiving people when you could have written a fiction book with those made up letters, as opposed to purporting them and handing them out to be true versions written by, say, Dorothy Parker.
I tried to do respectable fiction and or humor and or reviews. Nobody was buying Lee Israel anymore.
Well, they're buying Lee Israel now. Talk about the reaction to this memoir.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I never got reviews like this in my life when I was writing respectable books. They're the kind of reviews that an author just obviously yearns for. The Times, New York Times Sunday section, the most important venue in the world, called the book, I have to blow my own bugle now because no one's here to talk on my behalf, pretty damn wonderful. It's climbing up on Amazon. People are loving it. People are loving it. And yes, they've forgiven me, most of them.
And so you were convicted of what crime?
I wasn't convicted for the forgeries. There was a grand jury sat, but for some reason, it's not unusual, they simply gave it up. But I was finally convicted of the stealing from important letters from literary archives in colleges throughout the country.
Now, how soon before we see the movie?
I don't know. I'm just
so there've been movie rights sold.
Signing it today to a company called This Is That. I ran one of their movies the other night, The Savages. It's wonderful. And we'll see. Everybody has a movie deal, right? This one may be done, and that would be something.
All right, Lee, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Lee Israel, a biographer and copy editor and author of Can You Ever Forgive Me? Memoirs of a Literary Forger. And I know that we will have more about this on our website, thetakeaway.org. Going to turn now to Femi Oke and the latest headlines. Thanks, Femi.
Good morning, Catherine. 21 minutes to the hour. Some 2,000 troops are headed home from Iraq to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Georgia called them home to help in the fighting against Russia in the deepening crisis over the breakaway regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Coalition forces in Afghanistan called in airstrikes on a house in the south of the country earlier today, killing 25 pro-Taliban insurgents and 8 civilians the militants were holding as hostages. 3 civilians survived the strike. They're being treated for their injuries. And a study of 7,000 service stations shows that gas prices are down in the U.S. The average price per gallon was $3.85 as of Friday. That's down a $4.15 from just 2 weeks ago. And finally, do you remember the 1975 series The Invisible Man with David McCullum? Ah, brings back memories from my cradle, of course. Now, the fiction of this series may actually turn into fact. That's thanks to researchers at the University of California in Berkeley, who say that they've developed a material that can bend light around 3D objects, which basically, in normal speak, means they can make things disappear. The artificially made material is very small at the moment, but if they can make it on a huge scale, then all sorts of things might be possible. Dora is smiling there.
Forget the Invisible Man. What about Harry Potter?
It's a very exciting development. What's also quite intriguing is that
we're not quite as thrilled as you are, Femi. I'll believe it when I can see it. Get it? No pun. No pun. See it? Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to Isaac Hayes, Never Can Say Goodbye. Hayes died yesterday at his home in Memphis. He was 65 years old. And joining us for more on this man's extraordinary career, Terrence McKnight, WNYC's host of Evening Music. And Terrence, he was cool.
Here's a guy who was not only cool, but he was born a pauper. I mean, Isaac Hayes grew up delivering groceries, shining shoes, delivering firewood. But by the time he died, not only did he die a prince, but he died a king. And he was one of those pioneers at Stax Records. He was an actor. He was a philanthropist, a father, a husband, a cultural icon. And a few years ago, he actually was coronated king of the Ada Coastal District in Ghana, where he built an educational facility. So he was a real important person in American music.
You had all of these facets of this man. He was an early Renaissance man coming up in the 60s, right?
And he kept reinventing himself, Adora. And not only did he reinvent himself, but as you can hear, he was able to reinvent music. This music comes from an album called the Black Moses Album, 1971. But even before this, he had written 200 hits. Hot Buttered Soul was his first important album.
And that's it right now.
That's right, 1969. He had long tracks, you know, where most tracks were like 2.5, 3 minutes. Isaac Hayes in this track, in this album, had 4 tunes, 5 minutes, 9 minutes, 12 minutes, 18 minutes. So he was really the first to create fully realized concept albums and force people to listen to commercial radio just a little bit differently.
And then everyone started doing that. This notion of a themed record as opposed to individual songs, but somehow they all tied together in this theme. That was something that everyone, every musician of every stripe, it seems, does now.
And then it led him into what was perhaps his most recognizable record, the music that's most recognizable with Isaac Hayes. It's this music from Shaft, 1971.
Chef is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Chef.
So now this score earned him an Oscar. It earned him a Grammy. And it gave him a real interest in acting, and he can be seen in more than 40 films now.
And he just finished a movie, ironically and somewhat surreally, with Samuel Jackson and also with
Bernie Mac,
the comedian who died just several days before Isaac Hayes. very surreal.
Soul Men.
Soul Men was the name of the movie, and you talked about him moving into acting. Not only did he act in movies, he also used his voice. Let's see if you can guess what this is from.
Let me sing you a little song. It might clear things up. I'm make love to you, woman. Gonna lay you down by the fire. And caress your womanly body. Make you moan and perspire. Gonna get those juices flowing. Yeah. We're making love, baby. Yeah.
Here's a guy who continued to reinvent himself, whether it's South Park or whether it's in film, whether it's radio. He was a radio host, whether it's arranging music, whether it's him as a civil rights activist. He just kept reinventing himself.
And that was his iconic playing of Chef. Isaac Hayes died at 65, and we're listening to Nothing Takes the Place of You.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have some headlines for you on this Monday, August 11th, and they're coming straight from Femi Oke, who's been covering the news. Femi?
Hello there. Here's a wrap of your main stories at 12 minutes to the hour. The Russian military has issued an ultimatum to Georgian forces near Abkhazia, the country's other breakaway region, to disarm or face attack. The UN is estimating that 20,000 civilians have been forced to flee their homes since fighting broke out in the former Soviet Republic. Verizon and two unions have reached a deal on a new three-year contract. The unions, representing 65,000 workers, had threatened a walkout just after midnight. Authorities in Montreal have made arrests after riots shook the north part of the city last night. Young people began looting and setting fires in the area after an incident in a park left one teenager dead. He was shot by police. And government opposition parties in Zimbabwe are due to resume power-sharing talks later today. Negotiations broke down yesterday after 14 straight hours. President Robert Mugabe says he's confident a deal will be signed. And a bus run by the same company linked to a deadly crash in Texas has been pulled out of service in Missouri. Federal safety officials ordered the company to cease operations because they say it posed an imminent hazard. And that's a main wrap-up of your stories for this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
We're going to stay with the headline to talk about what's going on in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic. A senior general says Russian troops have been ordered not to move further into Georgian territory today. The general says Russia has demanded that Georgian troops near Abkhazia, disarm. Georgia fears Russia may open a second front in the conflict over South Ossetia. The weekend's violence in this fragile region is no surprise to James Traub. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. James, you've been covering the story. What finally triggered this escalation?
You know, I think that's probably right now the single most mysterious aspect of this. There have been a growing series of incidents in South Ossetia, which is one of these two breakaway republics, over the course of the last month. Georgian Interior Ministry troops there. It's a very complicated situation. There's one government, which is the government of the de facto independent Republic of South Ossetia. There's another government which is loyal to the Georgians. It's a very complicated, messy situation. And I don't know that we're going to know for quite a while what was the actual trigger of the violence there. I think the key thing, though, is to distinguish between whatever it was that started the hostilities in South Ossetia and what is happening now, which is that Russia is invading a sovereign country, and that is supposed to be unacceptable in the world we live in today.
They claim they're not, that they moved into the provinces, the breakaway provinces, to secure the borders. And, of course, as you say, very complicated situation. Describe this three-way relationship that exists between Georgia, the provinces, and Russia.
Right. It's very complicated. The miniature history of the whole thing is that when the Soviet Union finally collapsed in 1990, Georgia declared its independence. South Ossetia and Abkhazia are two provinces that had this kind of special relationship under Soviet rule, but they were part of Georgia. And so when Georgia declared independence, that was part of Georgia. Those two areas, though, which were ethnically distinct, in effect, they said, no, we don't want to be part of Georgia. And so really violent civil wars in both places took place in the early 90s. And the situation has been frozen since then, with Russia acting as a peacekeeper in both places. It all got unfrozen over the last couple of years, and above all in recent months, when Russia reacted to something quite unrelated, which is the decision of the West to recognize Kosovo, which Russia opposed. And Russia said, we're not going to let this stand. We're going to punish the West. And one of the places where they took this out on the West was against the West's darling, Georgia, by stepping up the hostilities, mostly in Abkhazia, not in South Ossetia. In a way, it's surprising that the war broke out in the one place and not the other. But if you saw how tense the situation was, I was in Abkhazia, it was clear that anything could provide the spark that would set off this kind of conflict, though I think even so, people are surprised that Russians have carried it as far as they have.
Well, you mentioned, in fact, in your analysis piece yesterday, that talking to the Georgians about Abkhazia and to the Abkhaz about Georgia was like shuttling between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What kind of hope does that give us?
Not much. I mean, the Georgians are quite blind on this subject. I mean, I could speak about Abkhazia in that regard more easily than I can South Ossetia because I was in Abkhazia. And it is really striking that from the point of view of the Abkhaz, they've been historically mistreated by Georgia. They have generations worth of grievances, but especially over this war that they fought in 1992 and years subsequent, they feel that Georgia has been a kind of big bullying neighbor. So it sounds a little bit like the way the Georgians talk about Russia. And so if we're thinking about how we're going to resolve this situation, the immediate thing, as I say, is that there's something quite simple here, not complicated. The simple thing is Russia has now gone into Georgia's own proper territory. I don't mean in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. I mean in what everyone recognizes as Georgia. Right now, Russia is trying to take a Georgian city, Gori. Russia is bombing major Georgian capitals. They're bombing the Tbilisi airport, that's the capital of Georgia, and they have 10,000 troops who are massed on the border. So that, we have to say, is unacceptable. But there's a need for a long-term negotiated solution in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and that will not be easy, but that requires engagement from both sides, and it requires that the Russians withdraw from their role as peacekeeper, because you clearly can't be a peacekeeper in a situation where you are one of the combatants. So they need to be replaced by some kind of international, perhaps European, perhaps civilian force.
James, that does strike you as odd when you hear Russian peacekeepers considering that they have a very vested interest in this arena. And you hear a lot of talk over the weekend about how this is turning into a proxy, right, where you have this pro-Western Georgian government who has been supported so much by George W. Bush that they actually named a street after him in their country, and has proven to be a real thorn in the side of Vladimir Putin during his presidency days. But now it appears that Putin has taken on a leadership role here as prime minister, that you have all of these Cold War themes roiling around in this very conflict today. True?
You do. Yeah, you do. But in a way, it's a kind of one-sided Cold War, which is Georgia has the right to align itself with the West if they want, just as if Armenia, another local state, chose to freely align itself with Russia because they think it's in their interest, well, they can do so. This is not the 19th century. And so, you know, states are supposed to have sovereign rights, and certainly that includes the question of countries they wish to align themselves to, organizations they wish to be associated with, and so forth. So Putin's Russia acts as if states have the right to control the countries on the other side of their borders, as if there's a sphere of influence world that we live in. Well, we're not supposed to live in that world anymore. We don't recognize the right of the United States to control Mexico. And in the same way, we don't recognize the right of Russia to control Georgia. So that part, I think that's what I want to keep stressing, is that part is simple and straightforward and utterly unacceptable. And so we can't just say that's Russia's mentality and therefore pardon the act.
James, very quickly, your thoughts on what to expect now. You have the EU mediator trying to get involved. You have Condoleezza Rice and the president very strongly encouraging Russia to pull back. What happens now?
Well, you know, nobody has much influence here. The real operative question is, how much does Putin want? Putin doesn't really care about all of these cries for mediation and so forth. He'll take what he wants. He clearly already wants more than people expected. He's trying to take Gori, a city in Georgia. I don't think he's going to try to take Tbilisi, the capital. That would be a monstrous war. But what he wants is to tell the Georgians that they are subject to his will. And so the key thing on the part of the West is, what can we do? Once the smoke clears, once the immediate hostilities end, what can we do to make it clear that's not so? He can't do as he wishes with Georgia.
James Trubb, thank you. James is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, whose most recent article is a long profile of the history and background of the conflict about Russia and Georgia. It is worth reading and explaining, as you know, Catherine, what's happening in that region right now.
Yeah, no, it was a really good piece. I want to remind you that we are always here at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter.
And on today's show, the latest from the conflict in Georgia, and we're onto Black Radio, chatting with a literary outlaw and remembering the iconic Isaac Hayes.
And our guest, Lee Israel, who she just mentioned, forged hundreds of letters and autographs. Whose letters would you want to forge? Have you ever claimed someone else's work as your own? Go ahead, tell us. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And here's today's takeaway.
No, I was 22 in Albertville. I was, you know, I was already voting and drinking and all those things.
That's Jeremy Schapp, ESPN's Jeremy Schapp in Beijing, covering his 7th Olympics for that network.
Don't forget to give us your take on the day's news. You can find us at thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanford.
And I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
What if there were an Olympic event for the Monday morning commute? And they're off. A reminder, these are the qualifying heats for the commuting pentathlon event, and we see a mad dash to the train by England. Ooh, nice toe extension there on the closing door. Looks like China is not far behind, a bottleneck on the stairs there. U.S., Sweden, and Luxembourg, they've been training with weighted briefcases for this event. Ooh, Luxembourg goes down. That has got to hurt. The defending champions of getting you up on time, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 11th. Catherine Lanford is in for John Hockenberry, who's away. We're talking about the latest from the Beijing Olympics. Also, politics in Pakistan and Bolivia, two leaders under siege. Oil prices are down. So does that mean the economy is looking up? The conflict in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Attacks are taking place not only on the ground, but in cyberspace, too. And in politics, a look ahead for the week. Those stories are coming up. But first, good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora.
Let's get to the headlines.
In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, CNN is reporting that President Mikhail Saakashvili has signed an international brokered ceasefire proposal. It's an attempt to bring the fighting between his country and Russia to an end. He says the proposal will now be taken to Moscow by the French and Finnish foreign ministers. Saakashvili says Georgian troops have shot down nearly 20 Russian warplanes. President Bush says he's urged both Russia and Georgia to end fighting over the breakaway province of South Ossetia.
I only said it to Vladimir Putin. I said it to the president of the country, Dmitry Medvedev. And my administration has been engaged with both sides in this, trying to get a ceasefire.
Two separate suicide bombers have struck the area northeast of Baghdad, killing at least three people and wounding 18. A female suicide bomber struck a market checkpoint in the provincial capital of Baquba. Another bomb exploded 12 miles east of Baquba.
Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf is awaiting charges that may lead to his impeachment, but Musharraf says he'll not step down. Governing coalition leaders meet today to finalize their plan to try to remove him from office. Tributes continue today for legendary soul singer and songwriter Isaac Hayes. Hayes was pronounced dead yesterday after his wife found him unconscious near a treadmill in his Memphis home. Isaac Hayes was 65 years old.
U.S. Olympic swimmer Jason Lezak turned in a stunning come-from-behind win in the men's 400 freestyle relay to help teammate Michael Phelps win his second gold medal. This keeps Phelps on track to meet his goal of winning 8 gold medals. The National Lundberg Survey says the price of a gallon of gas has dropped to $3.85. That's a drop of almost 15 cents in the past 2 weeks. Oil prices have jumped to near $117 a barrel on fears of a widening conflict between Russia and Georgia, and the Dow was up more than 2.5% to close at 11,734, the S&P up over 2%. That's the takeaway. Today we're going to be talking about the economy. Gas prices have fallen. Are you changing your plans? Go to mytake at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday. It's August 11th, and today I'm joined by Catherine Lamfer, who's sitting in for John Hockenberry. And we're going to start in Pakistan. Embattled Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf is refusing to resign amid greater calls for his resignation. His spokesman said that today, as Parliament convened to discuss the impeachment against him, he remains defiant. Musharraf is a key U.S. anti-terror ally. For more, we go now to MJ Goel, who is the director of the Asian Pacific Foundation, an independent international affairs think tank that studies security issues. MJ, so where exactly, good morning, where exactly are the impeachment proceedings at this particular time?
Well, the impeachment proceedings were announced last week, and the two main political parties, the PPP and the PMLN, have moved fairly quickly. They've called a special session of the National Assembly, which is Pakistan's lower house of parliament, and they're meeting today to prepare the charge sheet for impeachment on President General Pervez Musharraf. Today is Musharraf's 65th birthday by coincidence, and if he's impeached, this will be the first time in Pakistan's history that this has happened.
And is there any sense, initially there were thoughts that perhaps the impeachment proceedings would actually begin today. Is there any significance to the fact that the charges are still in the middle of a legislative process?
Well, I think they're going to put the charges together. They also want to first consider passing a vote of no confidence in him in the hope that Musharraf will see good sense and quietly resign and go away. But the chances are that he won't do that, and so a charge sheet will be prepared. And the charge sheet is likely to be quite lengthy, covering the fact that he usurped the democratically elected government of Nawaz Sharif in 1999. Then he launched a second coup in November of last year when he sacked all the Supreme Court judges. He sacked 60 other judges, locked up thousands of opposition figures, civil liberty and human rights organizers and lawyers, and he shut down the media. And it has just been announced that a third charge is now being added, which is that that Asif Zardari, the leader of the PPP and the husband of late Benazir Bhutto, has said that Musharraf has been involved in misappropriation of the huge amount of U.S. aid that Pakistan received. In fact, they're saying that Musharraf misappropriated a whopping $700 million of American aid to Pakistan, and that Musharraf's friends in the military and radical Islamists in Pakistan's notorious intelligence agency, the ISI, benefited. Now, this will ring huge alarm bells in Washington.
And certainly covers a lot of ground. It almost sounds, though, MJ, that a lot of old political scores are being settled. Nawaz Sharif now helping to run the country of Pakistan.
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of old scores are being settled. They all despise each other. Let's not forget that Musharraf removed Nawaz Sharif. Nawaz Sharif, in fact, had locked up Zardari, Benazir Bhutto's husband. There were corruption charges against Zardari and Nawaz Sharif. The thing is that they, at the moment, the two-party political leaders hate Musharraf more than they hate each other. And the trouble is that the situation in Pakistan is always very fluid and very murky. Nothing is very simple. And one thing's for sure, that Musharraf will not go quietly. He is very much in savior mode, a bit like Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Musharraf feels that only he can save the country. Eventually, Musharraf may have to be dragged out of office kicking and screaming. And this is perhaps where Washington can help. If Washington encourages Musharraf to resign quietly, it may bring some stability back to Pakistan. Otherwise, Pakistan's heading into very murky, dangerous waters, and this is a country with nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, plus it is also the headquarters for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Well, it's interesting that we haven't heard a lot from the U.S. about what's happening to Musharraf at the moment. You want to quickly sum up what the response has been? Because it certainly has not been very widespread, very consistent, and very loud.
You're right. Washington is disenchanted with Musharraf. Musharraf has not done enough in the war on terrorism. Washington has said that this is an internal matter, so effectively they've left it to the Pakistanis to decide. But behind the scenes, they'll be hoping that good sense will prevail. And also, let's not forget that the Bush administration is in the last few months of its second term. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, Washington doesn't have as much influence as it had before.
MJ Gohel, thank you. MJ is the director of the Asia Pacific Foundation, a London-based international affairs think tank and part of the United Nations roster of experts with their terrorism prevention branch. Catherine?
We're continuing our conversation on the latest in what's happening in between Georgia and Russia. We're going to turn now to Anne Bernard. She is covering this for one of our partners, the New York Times, and she's going to join us by phone from Moscow. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Now, a senior general has said that Russian troops plan to stay in two breakaway Georgian provinces and not move further into Georgian territory. And the same general says that Russia is also asking Georgian troops to disarm. For those of us trying to keep score at home, I thought it was the Georgians asking the Russians to disarm.
Well, exactly. Each side portrays the other as the aggressor in this situation. The Georgians say that they went into the separatist enclave of South Ossetia to stop Russians from attacking Georgian enclave there, whereas the Russians say it was the Georgians' attempt to take back the capital of that enclave was bringing Russian peacekeepers under fire, and the Russians went in to protect those peacekeepers.
Now, Russia has a military of some 1 million. Georgia has something like 20,000. So what does that say about this fight?
Well, it's a completely lopsided fight. And Georgia's president, Mikhail Saakashvili, is very pro-American and some would say gutsy, some would say hot-headed character who seems to relish taking on Russia. And in an interview today on a conference call with reporters, talked about how this proved that he's been right to build up Georgia's military. He's always claimed that Russia was going to use force to keep Georgia from turning towards the West. Now, of course, from the Russian point of view, Georgia is a thorn in its side, and Georgia's attempt to take back these separatist provinces who are pro-Russian, which are pro-Russian, it looks like, from the Russian point of view, it looks like Georgia is trying to keep the people in those separatist areas from having self-determination. And they point to a place like Kosovo, the Albanian enclave that recently won autonomy from Serbia with Western support, and they say if the West can have a deal like that, why can't we get a deal like that for our allies in these separatist areas of Georgia?
And Anne, do you think perhaps that Saakashvili miscalculated the geopolitics of the situation? In other words, he's had tremendous support from the United States, and from NATO and so on. Now, in this skirmish, it's really uneven. You're talking about his army is 20,000. The Russian army is over a million, or I should say the military. Clearly not a fair fight. Was he expecting the international community to be more involved in some way?
Well, it's hard to believe he could be so deluded. The United States was going to come in and protect him militarily. Even though Georgia has been seeking membership in NATO, the United States has never offered the protection to Georgia that NATO members enjoy, which is that if one is attacked, it's considered an attack on all. So it's hard to know what he thought was going to happen. It's possible that Georgia didn't plan this in advance, that they got drawn into a skirmish with Russian peacekeepers or Ossetian separatists in the territory, and then they decided to just go for it and see if they could take the territory back.
But Anne, it seems that reporting, in fact, from the New York Times earlier today, the refugees within Georgia are all bitterly complaining, saying, where's the United States? Where's America?
That's right. It's almost as if America is the unseen player in this game, in this fight. Here in Moscow, people have been picketing the American embassy, blaming America for emboldening Georgia, as the Russians see it, to start this fight.
Wow. All right. Well, Anne, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That is Anne Bernard. She is covering this for one of our production partners, the New York Times. And, of course, Adora, we're going to keep people up with the latest on this. I didn't know that latest one about the protesters in front of the embassy in Moscow.
And we should just probably note her line was so scratchy she was coming from Moscow.
Right.
So many thanks to her.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 11th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for John Hockenberry. We talked earlier to Lee Israel, author of Can You Ever Forgive Me? Memoirs of a Literary Forger. And we've been asking you, who would you like to forge? Which writer or personality do you aspire to be? Now, Vipul on our website says, I would forge Argentinian author Jorge Borges. The English translations, that is, very distinct and probably very difficult. Also, he says, thankfully, very short. What's your take? I know, smart man.
Quick, right?
Yeah, keep it to the haiku. I'm gonna forge haiku. What is your take? You can post it to our site at thetakeaway.org.
We're going to talk about the economy, and it looks like there may be some good news. Gas prices have fallen 2 weeks in a row, and that means, are you changing your plans? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE, and we want to know what you're thinking. This is that started off well this week, right? Gas prices down,
yeah.
Commodity prices down, stocks, maybe the stock market a little bit perky.
Right,
so perhaps
right.
We'll see some gains this week. The tide does seem to be turning, but Dan Gross, can we call these developments trends?
They're short-term trends for sure. We're heading off to Maine for the week, and I just went to fill up and paid $4.20 a gallon. So I think it's a little premature to think that we'll all be out there getting Hummers and driving with abandon anytime soon.
That's Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. $4.20 for you, but the average price has clearly dipped a lot. On Friday, according to the Lamberg survey, $3.83 per gallon average, which is down about 30 cents than the high about 6 weeks ago.
Absolutely. And, you know, the price of oil today, it's trading at about $115 a barrel. It was just about 6 weeks ago up at $147. So the market prices have come down about 20% really in the space of 2 months. That said, it's only getting us back to where we were, say, in May. But, you know, people, the mentality and psychology is such that even returning to what had been an elevated price, a year ago, if you had said you're going to pay $3.80 a gallon, people would have thought, oh, that's awful. Now it strikes us as being, you know, a pretty good deal.
We're like, what a great deal. Let's talk about the macro picture, though, because there are certainly some world events that could potentially affect the price of oil and don't seem to me. For example, you have militants in Nigeria who are threatening that supply line. You have this conflict, this escalating, seemingly escalating conflict in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And then you have the Iranians who continue to be defiant in the eyes of repeated international requests to stop enriching uranium. Why are these things not affecting the world price of oil?
Those types of factors you just mentioned are always there. Nigeria has been unstable for years and likely will be. Ditto for the Persian Gulf, and there are always flare-ups in the Caucasus. And that, I think, is sort of factored in. Obviously, if there's a huge implosion somewhere, that could send the price spiraling. But I think the market has kind of factored instability in general into the price of oil. And I think what's happened in recent weeks is a combination of two things. One is kind of prolonged what economists call demand destruction. In simpler terms, it's when something gets really expensive, people use less of it. And mm-hmm. we're seeing this here in America. The amount of gas we're consuming, and we're the world's biggest gas consumer, is off 3% year over year. And people are starting to see changes in behavior. So that's one of the things that has brought the price down. A second thing that has helped bring the price down to a degree is another big macroeconomic trend, the rally in the dollar. You know, around the world, oil is priced in dollars. So if the dollar is getting weaker, it means that the price of oil will, in effect, rise. And if the dollar is getting stronger, it means that, in effect, the price of oil, all things considered, will decline. You know, it takes fewer dollars to buy a barrel of oil today because the dollar has gotten a little weaker. So there are two big factors that have comparatively little to do with the sort of headlines we see coming out of places where oil is produced, and more to do with a couple of really big picture macroeconomic trends here at home and throughout the globe.
Okay, Dan, so what you're saying then is when your typical consumer looks at the world events and says, hey, we've got all this trouble with the oil here, doesn't that have any impact on what's going on with the price at the pump? It's hard not to think of manipulation somewhere.
No, I don't. I really think that this is a global market in the truest sense. And I think one of the things that has been so mystifying to American consumers over the past year, really, is this kind of disconnect between the fact that, A, we were using less gas, and, B, the price continued to rise. Because historically, Americans, we always remind ourselves, we are 4% of the world's population, but we use 25 to 30% of the world's energy. And in the past, if a consumer the size of the U.S. stopped using gas, stopped driving, that would cause the price of oil to plummet because we're the biggest consumer.
So it just really has a tremendous effect on the world market. Dan, when you're taking a look at what's coming out, the numbers coming out this week, what are you going to be watching for to see whether or not this is truly a turn for the economy here in the United States?
I'm primarily going to be looking at the price of lobster per pound in Maine. I understand it's down this year, and, you know, we've talked so much about food inflation. I've been told that this is the one item where food inflation is not actually hitting. They had a good harvest, and, you know, consumers' ability to pay for expensive crustaceans is on the wane. So that's, I'm going to be doing some extensive reporting on that this week.
Well, we've certainly learned, Dan, that you have one heck of a sense of humor. Dan Gross, many thanks. Dan Gross is the senior editor for Newsweek. And now we're going to go to Femi Okeh, who also has a sense of humor and some headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. In Iraq, two separate suicide bombers have struck the area northeast of Baghdad, killing at least three people and wounding 18. Elsewhere in Iraq, the Iraqi government says it's stopping military operations in the Diyala province for 1 week to give insurgents time to surrender. Federal authorities have shut down a bus company that is tied to Friday's deadly crash in Texas. The crash killed 17 members of a Vietnamese church group. Authorities say the bus company owner was ordered to shut it down in June, and instead he continued to run his unsafe fleet of buses under a new name, Iwana. Now, Friday's crash was attributed to a blown-out tire.
Bolivia's populist leader, Evo Morales, has won a referendum that should ensure he stays in power. But the vote did nothing to unify the heavily divided nation. Bolivia has split along class lines as Morales attempts to redistribute petroleum revenue and land among Bolivia's impoverished indigenous majority. Many people in the gas-rich eastern Bolivia resent attempts to cut their shares of gas revenue. They want greater autonomy. And finally, the US Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps is one step closer to his goal of winning 8 gold medals in Beijing. That's thanks in part to a remarkable come-from-behind victory by his teammate Jason Lezak in the 400 freestyle relay. I will have some news coming up later on of something from the Olympic ceremony that you saw, but you didn't really see. More later.
Forgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday. It's August 11th. And we've been talking a lot about the clashes between Russia and its former republic, Georgia, troops. And here's what one of you said.
Hi, this is Nick, Cliffside Park, New Jersey. By the way, has anybody considered that the real reason for this big war in Georgia is to get the prices of oil back up again? You think they really wouldn't do that? Thank you.
Well, there's a thought for you. Maybe you agree, maybe you disagree. Let's hear your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now I'm going to pass it off to Catherine Lamper, who's sitting in today for John Hockenberry.
Well,
Catherine?
Thank you so much. You know, we've been talking a lot about the Olympics, Dora. Of course, there was the amazing relay race.
Incredible.
Jason Lezak. I always want to make his name French. Lezak. And what he did for Michael Phelps. What he did for the entire team. There's been so much attention on this, though, that, you know, some of the other stories are getting left behind. And if you want the stories that have been left behind, there's really no one better to go to than Ollie Williams. He's one of our favorites here. He's an Olympics blogger and sports reporter for the BBC. I mean, this is a man, one of his beats is canoeing, okay? He's one of the events he's writing about. My favorite story of his so far is of a Thai weightlifter who won a gold medal after a fortune teller told her that she had to adopt a 32-letter last name. Okay, Ollie. Ollie Williams, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that person's name.
Good morning, Catherine. I think you should try. Okay, I'll give it a go. Prabhawadi Jaron Ratana Tarakun.
Oh, well, sure.
Yeah, you believe me?
Ollie, that sounded so great.
It's common spelling, right?
Absolutely, it's the common spelling. It's as you find it, you know, across the states. That's it, exactly.
So tell us the story here, yeah.
You will love this. Okay, so until 2007, this lady was known as Champim Kantatian, which is a fairly normal name. At least it's a shorter name, which is usually a good thing. And last year, she was unhappy that she wasn't getting the results she wanted. She went to a fortune teller. Fortune teller said that, and this is a quote from her, "If I changed my name, I would go far. So I changed it because I wanted to go to the Olympics." What happens? A year later, she is a weightlifting gold medalist. I think there's a lesson in that for all of us. Maybe you could be, I don't know, Catherine Jaron Ratana Tarakun.
You can't make this up, Ollie. You can't make it up.
You can't make it up. We talked about beach volleyball earlier, by the way.
Yes, we did talk about beach volleyball.
The Cubans
earlier.
They beat the U.S. team badly. They made them look like absolute amateurs.
And did you hear what happened to Kerry Walsh and her wedding ring?
Now, she, of course, is the great American beach volleyball player, and they
Absolutely.
Play on sand, and I think that's a key component of the story you're about to tell.
It's a key component indeed, yes. Lost the wedding ring in the sand while jumping up to block the ball in her opening match. She carried on regardless, very professional. At the end of the session, they sent an army of Olympic volunteers back to dig through the sand to find the ring, and somehow the organisers even managed to procure some metal detectors. It's incredibly convenient, I think, that you just happen to have metal detectors on standby for that sort of thing. They found some, eventually they got a beep, and a volunteer called Song Shendong dug the ring out of the sand to give back to her.
Ollie, you're bringing up something that I actually thought about when I was watching the beach volleyball, which is, how could anyone wear jewelry and compete in some of these games? I mean, unless she had a very modest ring, that would hurt.
Oh, you wait till you watch the track and field. In the triple jump, there's a British athlete called Phillips Iduwu who has bright pink hair and an incredible array of facial architecture.
Facial architecture?
Is sand involved there? Well, by which I mean piercings. It's a very posh way of saying piercings. But I think he might take a few of them out for that, because if you got that caught at the end of the triple jump...
Ouch.
Yeah.
Okay, now, I want us to talk about archery.
The archery.
Who knew? What? And for the people who haven't been keeping up on archery, could you explain, please, the drama, the tears... the emotion?
I certainly can. I mean, thousands of chanting supporters, thunder and lightning on a biblical scale, flooding, women's in tears. It can only be archery. I'll tell you what, this is actually a fascinating sport to watch. I guarantee if you've not watched archery before, it's more exciting than you think it is. But yeah, over the weekend, huge thunderstorms all over the Olympic Green in Beijing. The tennis was almost completely washed out. Our reporter there said you'd need a submarine to leave the venue. The hockey carried on, which is very brave of them. But it turned out that the archery was the worst hit, so much so that our reporter, one of my fellow Olympic bloggers, a gentleman named Tom, had to hide underneath his desk to escape the thunder and lightning, because it's an outdoor venue. And they actually did carry on for quite some time playing in an incredible rainstorm. And I don't even want to think about how hard it is to shoot a bow, well, shoot an arrow, about 75 yards in a thunderstorm.
Now, hang on a minute. Are these wooden arrows or are they metal?
Okay.
Because if you
think of Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood, it's nothing like that. You have these massive, great big metal bows. They're called recurve bows, and I think they may even be carbon fiber.
How can you do that when there's lightning?
You can't, which I think is why they eventually abandoned it. They waited for it to get bad enough, and then eventually they had to get everybody off. But it's certainly a bit precarious. It adds a certain je ne sais quoi to an Olympic archery competition if you're having to face the elements at the same time.
You are posh. French and facial architecture. Now, quickly, empty seats at the Games.
Yeah, this is not good. Seems a lot of officials, media, corporate guest sponsors, they're just turning up for the occasional event now that they've got all these tickets. And that means that a lot of seats are being left empty at all kinds of venues. Beach volleyball is one of them, badminton's another. And it's a bit of a shame because the organisers have now had to ask their ticket holders to respect the events and not just turn up for the finals. Sydney, the venues were full to 94%. Athens got a lot of criticism for half-empty venues. It looks like the same is happening in Beijing. Scalping is illegal in China. The police are conducting sweeps to round up people who try. So it's really tough to get tickets, and it can be tough selling them if you don't want them. And then these stadia are left half-empty. It's a shame.
Now, Ali, I know that we'll be talking to you again very quickly. What are you going to be watching tomorrow?
What am I going to be watching tomorrow? I'm a big canoeing fan, like you said at the start. The slalom canoeing, it's something I'd love to do. I've been out in a kayak once, maybe twice. The last time I got beached on some sand and had to be rescued by a man in a powerboat. Yeah. So it's fair to say I'm going to be watching the pros later today and tomorrow, and I'll be enjoying that.
A man in a canoe.
Oh, you got to love Ollie. Now, if you've been listening to this, Ollie Williams, an Olympic blogger for the BBC, and you think, oh, now I want to read his blog, you can. Just go to thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry, and we turn now to Femi Oke, who's in for the news.
Thanks so much. 20 minutes to the hour. A U.S. official says the world's seven largest economic powers are calling on Russia to accept an immediate ceasefire with Georgia and agree to international mediation over the crisis in Georgia's separatist areas. There's violence in the northeastern Iraqi province of Diyala today. A female suicide bomber killed one person and wounded 14 others in the provincial capital of Bakuba. And 12 miles east of the city, another bomb killed two women and injured four other people. Deposed Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat and his wife didn't show up in court today to face corruption charges. So Thailand's highest court has issued arrest warrants for the billionaire former first couple. Mr. Shinawat and his wife are in Britain, where he says, and I quote, "Democracy is more important," end of quote. And that's a look at some of the main stories making your news this morning.
Thanks, fam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. It's August 11th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, filling in here on The Takeaway for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And we're going to turn to cyberspace, because before the tanks started rolling in and the bombs started raining down in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, there was a less visible war taking place. Apparently, hackers were attacking the websites of the Georgian government and bringing internet traffic basically to an entire halt and crashing systems. Just this weekend, Russian websites came under the same kind of attacks, and really a full-fledged cyber war, if we can call it that, looked like it got underway. Joining us with more is Bill Woodcock, a research director for Packet Clearinghouse, who actually advises governments and internet companies about the threats of cyber attacks. Thanks for joining us, Bill. What kind of attacks? I know you've been following what's been going on in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. What kind of attacks were seen both in Russia and Georgia on the internet?
So basically, these kinds of cyber attacks, when they're used in a state-on-state military way, are referred to as information warfare by the militaries. Clearly, they're illegal actions by civil terms in pretty much every country. This is part of a larger pattern for Russia, particularly over the last 2 years, that has targeted both internal opposition parties and the press within Russia, and external targets like Estonia, notably last year, Lithuania, and some other countries that have had foreign policy that's disagreed with Russia's.
What do the attacks consist of, and what do the attacks debilitate?
So the attacks specifically in the Georgian case have been from Russia against the presidential and parliamentary websites in Georgia, and from Georgia against RIA Novosti, the Russian state news agency in Russia. Their denial of service attacks, DDoS, which is when many Microsoft Windows machines, most belonging to just individuals in their homes, are infected by viruses, and the person who infected them uses them all to collectively attack a single target. So in this case, the websites of the Georgian government and the Russian state news agency on the other side. And each of the infected machines sends as much traffic as possible, overwhelming the target and making it unavailable to its intended users.
I mean, obviously a sign of the times, right? How much disruption do these attacks really cause?
Well, you can imagine that here in the United States, if some foreign power targeted the website of the White House, for instance, probably it would be weeks before anybody noticed. But as soon as someone pointed it out, it would be seen as a national affront. So that's, at one level, what's happening. On the other hand, all of the capacity that's used to conduct the attack, all of the internet bandwidth that's consumed in that process, is made unavailable to the entire country. So
I see.
In the case of Georgia, where mm-hmm. it's 100 times smaller than Russia, that's a lot of bandwidth removed from the national capacity.
A lot of bandwidth. Bill Woodcock, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks to you.
My pleasure. Thank
Bill
you.
Bill Woodcock, Research Director for Packet Clearinghouse.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's, I was going to say Thursday, Catherine, but that would be wrong.
No, it's
August 11th. And Femi Okeh has the very latest headlines at this hour. Femi?
Thanks very much. It is 12 minutes to the hour. On the third day of competition at the Beijing Olympics, Michael Phelps has won his second gold medal. That's two down, six to go, in his bid to win a record-breaking 8 gold medals. He helped the US to victory in the men's 400-meter freestyle relay. Today, the world's seven largest economic powers are calling on Russia to respect Georgia's borders and have expressed deep concern for civilian casualties. The UN is estimating that some 20,000 civilians in Georgia have been forced to flee their homes since clashes began in the former Soviet Republic. In Kabul today, a suicide bomber rammed a car into a NATO convoy, killing three civilians and wounding some 12 other people, NATO troops among them. And Afghanistan's northwest, another attack on a NATO convoy wounded 14 people, most of them civilians. Telecommunications giant Verizon has narrowly avoided a strike this morning. The company made a deal with two unions representing 65,000 workers. They were threatening a walkout if they didn't get a new contract. And let's just recap and go back to Friday's Olympic ceremony. Have a listen to this and the excitement and the fireworks. 91,000 people in the crowd. The crowd literally did go wild. But according to the London's Telegraph newspaper, if you were watching the fireworks on television, not all of them were real fireworks.
What?
Some of them were computer generated. Now, it doesn't mean that they weren't set off at the stadium, but not at that particular moment, because the helicopters covering the event would have basically exploded with all of that firepower up there. So for the television viewers, some of those aerial shots were actually digitally enhanced. Is that faking it?
Yes.
It was good faking, though, wasn't it?
So this is happening simultaneously, and they're representing these fireworks as if they are happening, and they weren't.
If you were watching on TV, they weren't, but they were going to the stadium, but not that particular moment.
Well, I just want to point out that there was something else that was going on under the cover of those fireworks. John Edwards, his interview about his affair, in which he said that he needed to ask for his wife's forgiveness. Well, there are some Democrats who think that he should be asking for their forgiveness as well. Ben Smith is a reporter for Political.com. Now, okay, Ben, who exactly should John Edwards be asking for forgiveness from?
Well, the people who are angriest at him are Democrats who supported him, notably his former campaign manager, David Vanier, who could right now be in the middle of this nightmare where he was the nominee and his campaign was falling apart and the Democrats were losing the White House because he had lied about this affair a couple of years ago. So some of them are very angry. You know, others of them, one of his senior aides said to me, look, what was he supposed to do? Admit it? He was running for president. So.
Now, what impact does this have on the upcoming Democratic convention, if any?
It frees a little space on the podium is the main impact. He had been expected to give a primetime speech, and now he won't. So it's one more slot for a member of the Kennedy family or something like that.
I was just going to say, that's another slot for it. It means Bill Clinton can talk a little longer, right?
he will anyway.
But on a more serious note, though, Ben, I mean, there was a lot of talk that when Edwards backed Barack Obama a couple of months ago, that perhaps he could help Barack Obama with what at the time was a real gap that Obama had with working class white men, particularly. Does this in any way impinge upon what the Obama campaign might have hoped, which was to send John Edwards out to campaign in those areas on his behalf where he needed that support?
You know, I don't think that was ever that serious. Edwards, although he sort of his routine was as tribune of the working class white men, his voters were actually the highest income voters of any of the candidates. Hillary Clinton was kind of actually the one winning that group. So no, I don't think there's really major fallout for anybody except him.
And you would say that in terms of the overall. So all of this media attention is just because of the salacious nature of this story and because we're nosy?
I think it's mostly because we're nosy and because, he was the sort of, to me at least, the notion that he could have been the nominee and that he was taking this incredible risk as he ran for president, that Elizabeth, who knew about it, was too, is kind of an amazing story, just on the merits.
But what about the fact that people were so slow to report it?
There were a lot of news organizations that for some reason are beating themselves up about this. There was this story in the National Enquirer. There were a lot of other outlets, and I think including our media reporter, talked to the Enquirer, and they said, well, we're going to have these pictures. And then they didn't produce these pictures, and we didn't want to kind of jump on a story that, as you say, wasn't like any consequences were going to hinge on whether this was reported, this week or next week. So I think a lot of news organizations were, careful and appropriately careful.
Ben, what stories are you looking at this week as we move closer to the conventions? We're talking weeks away at this point. What kinds of things should we be looking out for this week, meaningful, that you think will be meaningful?
Well, you know, it's August, so it's hard to know what's meaningful. Both candidates are, you know, looking for vice presidential nominees. Obama is in Hawaii this week on vacation, so we're sort of led to believe that he's really taking the week off and won't be, you know, popping up in Virginia with a running mate on Tuesday or anything like that. But although you never know. And then obviously the war in Georgia is a huge story, and the way the two candidates are reacting. McCain taking a sort of instantly very anti-Russian line. Obama with Bush and others initially being a little more cautious. And, you know, so it was sort of an interesting moment in how they would actually deal with a real messy international crisis.
What did you say, Barack Obama with Bush?
Yeah, Bush, Obama, and most world leaders were initially sort of calling on all sides to disengage, including Bush and Obama, notably, and McCain was notably kind of to the right of both of them and was immediately condemning Russia. So it was, I mean, sort of an interesting moment as Bush sort of in his second term moves back toward a kind of foreign policy mainstream, and McCain sounds a little more like Bush of the first term.
Now, we have the first joint appearance, I believe it is, of John McCain and Barack Obama coming up. This week's on Saturday at Rick Warren's mega church in Southern California. What are expectations for that?
Well, I mean, it's a forum where Obama should really excel. He's somebody who, part of the reason that he's seen as a strong candidate is because he can actually talk about his religious faith in a way that a lot of Democrats can't, and in a way that John McCain doesn't really come from a tradition where he can kind of, he's an Episcopalian. It doesn't come from a particularly expressive tradition, and Obama, unlike a lot of Democrats, actually is very fluent in talking about how he came to Jesus, which is not something you're going to hear John McCain talk about, so it's kind of a reversal.
Huh. Does any of this stuff really stick, Ben? Or do you think that conventional wisdom holds, which is this year will be like every other presidential election year, which is voters don't really start making up their mind until after the conventions?
Well, it seems like the thing that a lot of people hoped, which is not happening, is that this country, the country is less divided, that, you know, it's all going to reunite around one of these two candidates. I mean, it seems like, as usual, it's a very divided country. You've got, you know, a solid 40% or more firmly in either camp, and so they're fighting over the middle.
They're fighting over the middle, and some people say, actually, much to Barack Obama's dismay, he has really not taken off in the polls as some of his supporters might have expected, given the level of enthusiasm and support that he's gotten over the time. Is that more indicative of just how divided we are in America when it comes to the issues?
There's a lot of debate over what that's an indicator of. I mean, first of all, he's winning, and it's the winner wins in this race. There's no, you know, there's a close second doesn't get you anywhere. So he shouldn't be too upset about that. But yeah, there's a lot, you know, whether it's the fact that this is just a divided country and the Democrat was going to do poorly, or whether it's because he's the first African-American nominee and there's some voters who just aren't going for that, or if there's, you know, another reason about him or about McCain, you know, who at least used to be seen as this very independent, appealing character, and is probably a much stronger Republican candidate than any of the other possibilities.
All right, Ben, thank you so much. Ben Smith is a blogger and reporter for Politico.com.
We're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, and Twitter.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Today's show, Pakistan, the cyber conflict in Georgia.
And, of course, we're checking in on the Olympics. What's your Olympic event for your Monday morning commute? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Now, and here's today's takeaway.
If I changed my name, I would go far. So I changed it because I wanted to go to the Olympics.
That was Ollie Williams, Olympics blogger for the BBC. He was talking about the gold-winning Thai weightlifter who changed her name because a fortune teller told her she'd win if she did. What's that name? I am so not saying that. We're going to put it on our website because that 31-letter name looks so hard to pronounce.
It does, but Ollie did it so well. So you can listen to Ollie's podcast to find out if you're right or not. And let us know what your take is on the day's news. Find us at thetakeaway.org. Listen to our show online. Weigh in.
I had so much fun today. Let's do this tomorrow.
You think?
I think.
Are we going to do this? Is there going to be another show tomorrow, Dean? Are we doing that again? Are we doing this again tomorrow? He's shaking his head. That's our senior vice president.
I'm Catherine
Lanfer.
I think
we'll be back tomorrow.
Good. Whew. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.